Welcome to the Cold Steel Podcast, hosted by Amir Farouk and myself, Chad Ball. We consider it an absolute privilege to bring you guests from around the world who are truly experts in their craft. Our mission is to offer you a combination of not only masterclasses on clinical surgery topics, but also insights into achieving personal growth, productivity, and fulfillment as both a surgeon and perhaps more importantly, as a human.
This week, we were joined by Dr. Bill Kent, a cardiac surgeon at the University of Calgary, to talk about minimally invasive techniques in cardiac surgery. We were curious to learn where MIS techniques fit in an era of rapid evolution in cardiac surgery, and particularly with the advent of new catheter-based valve replacement techniques. Dr. Kent had a number of important insights into the introduction of new technologies in surgery and the challenges associated with trying something new.
You know, I grew up in Sarnia, Ontario, Canada. I grew up in a family that with no doctors. So the fact that I've ended up here as a heart surgeon was would have been an unlikely path, I think. My father was a judge, and I kind of felt that I would follow in his footsteps. And then as I learned more about it, I thought not quite suited to follow that career path. So I actually did a undergraduate degree at the University of Western Ontario, and I specialized initially in a liberal arts degree. I became interested in psychology, actually, and I did a psychology undergrad degree. Through that, I got interested in biopsychology and neuroscience. And through that path, I became interested in medicine. So I went into medical school after doing a master's in neuroscience. I did my master's at University of Western Ontario, and then I did a medical degree at Queen's University. I did a general surgery residency, also at Queen's University. And at the end of my training in general surgery, I became interested in cardiac surgery. I think, you know, our career paths are often determined by our mentors. And I had a real good mentor at Queen's who was a cardiac surgeon. And as I was finishing my general surgery training, he sort of said to me, I spent a lot of time with him. I thought I could learn a lot from this guy. And he sort of said, why aren't you doing cardiac surgery? And I said, no, I'm very happy in general surgery. I'm enjoying the career I'm going to have in it. And he sort of said, well, I really think you should do cardiac. And then so I said, well, I mean, I don't know. It's not sort of what I was planning on doing. He said, you know, I'm going to look into some programs and see if there's just an option for you. And I said, well, sure. I mean, might like entertain it slightly. He came back to me the next day and said, I got you all lined up for a position in cardiac surgery in Edmonton. So I, you know, it's funny, you know, you have often fall into a career path that you didn't really previously determine. And this was a default sort of thing. So I ended up in training in Edmonton in cardiac surgery, and that's where things started. Long-winded answer, but it was a circuitous path.
You know, it's so funny how often, right, we see that sort of circuitous voyage as you describe it, and people who are real successful in life, whether it's in medicine or elsewhere. And I totally agree. I mean, our mentors really do guide us, whether we have the consciousness to understand it at any given time or not. But no, that's really cool. You know, as you and I mentioned, or as I mentioned to you before the start of the podcast, most of our listeners are not all, but most are general surgeons throughout really an international audience, and won't necessarily be up to speed on the latest advancements in cardiac surgery. I was wondering, you know, with that in mind, then, if you could frame some of the real recent advances that you guys have seen on the heart side of things. And I'm curious in particular, you know, we all know you locally, and I think across the country, as doing some really neat work with minimally invasive valves. I'm curious how you sort of worked your way into that and how that came about as well.
Yeah, well, you know, there's a direct line from my work as a general surgeon and learning about laparoscopic surgery that made minimally invasive valve surgery be an obvious fit for me when I became a cardiac surgeon. And I think a lot of those skills I learned in general surgery are very transferable to minimally invasive cardiac surgery. You know, we as general surgeons, we sort of take that for granted. It's so much a part of our training, using a scope, doing lap Coley's. I mean, these are things you learn as an R1. That's not the case in cardiac surgery training. This is all, you know, all open surgery. So I had that skill set, and I felt that using scopes and understanding how to do that really had an application in minimally invasive valve surgery. It's an exciting time, I think, in cardiac surgery in that field. I think that it's similar to, you know, 30 years ago in general surgery when, you know, minimally invasive techniques were in their infancy. So I think we're maybe 10, 15 years into it in cardiac surgery, recognizing that smaller incisions and less trauma, less bleeding, earlier post-operative mobility, all that has a real impact on patient outcomes. So that's very eager to take that field, subspecialty, I should say, in cardiac surgery forward.
Can you describe to us, Dr. Kent, what minimally invasive valve surgery really looks like, especially given our audience, as Dr. Ball said, is mostly non-cardiac surgeons?
Sure. So as we all know, most cardiac surgery is done through a sternotomy with an open approach. And sternotomy is a great approach for exposure. And still, you know, over 90% of cardiac surgery is done that way. But there's real limitation post-operatively in terms of mobility. So patients after sternotomy can't use their arms for 6 weeks. They can't drive. There's pain-related issues with sternotomy. We use stainless steel wires to support the sternum to allow it to heal. But there is that process, just like if you do an open reduction internal fixation of a femur, the same thing with a sternum, and it takes a while for that to heal. So it really limits your mobility post-op, and this is particularly true for patients that, you're requiring a walker or other issues like that. On top of that, bone bleeds. And so, a lot of the returns to the operating room are a result of sternal bleeding after cardiac surgery. And that can be anywhere, 2 to 5% of cases need to go back to the operating room for bleeding related to the sternum. So the approach with minimally invasive is to go make smaller incisions and go between the ribs. So, the most common approach I would use would be a right, fourth inner space mini thoracotomy, a 5 centimeter mini thoracotomy. That gives me access with the lungs dropped on cardiopulmonary bypass. It gives me access to the pericardium through the right side, enter the pericardium, and then a really good access to the mitral valve and the aortic valve. So it's really applicable to valve surgery the most, not quite so much to coronary surgery, just because you have to access all parts of the heart, but it can be done with coronary surgery too. Doing multiple mini thoracotomies.
So interesting. I'm curious, does the robot play any part in either local or international approaches? Or is it, the reason I'm asking, obviously, is that I'm biased. When I was trained to use the robot in the US as an HPB fellow, we were doing robotic Whipples. But, the truth is, honestly, that's a marketing scheme that we really don't engage in any sense in Canada at all. Is that similar in valve work or totally unrelated?
I think it is, Chad. I think there's a parallel there. There's a lot of enthusiasm for using the robot, particularly in the U.S., and not so much in Canada. I think that there are some limitations, and I think they're similar. With scopes, we're able to do complex surgery through real small incisions, and that's same in general surgery. And the robot, when you're working in the small incision, the robot doesn't give you that much more of an advantage. I think having the range of motion within the chest cavity might be an advantage, but on the other hand, you're losing that tactile sensation, and the whole efficiency of the operation is not quite what it could be, I think, at this point with robotics. And I think robotics will come along, and there will be a role. But right now, I mean, it's a you're spending at least twice as long in the operating room to do an operation that with a thoracoscope you could do in much more efficiently at this stage. Yeah, some would argue, but I feel that that's the general consensus at this stage.
Yes, that's so interesting. It sounds exactly like our pancreatic head resection world for sure.
Agreed.
How then does the MIS technology that you're using interface with purely catheter-based approaches, whether it's in terms of indications or whether it's in terms of expertise?
Yeah, I think the catheter-based approaches is another reason that minimally invasive surgery has been blossoming lately. And, you know, some of the technology that's used for transcatheter valve implantation. So, you know, in simple terms, valves can be collapsed down, and so they're can be introduced through small sheaths, like 9 or smaller French. So that technology has also allowed us to collapse valves, so valves can be implanted through smaller incisions. So, you know, it's sort of pushed the field forward, and it's also been a bit of a competition between surgeons and cardiologists. As surgeons start doing more valve work percutaneously, it's pushed us as surgeons to be better. It's been a good thing. So competition's always good, right, Chad?
Competition is definitely good. Mm-hmm. So in terms of, obviously, you know, broad strokes, who qualifies for an MIS type approach when you're doing a valve repair? Are most people amenable to that type of approach, or is it only certain specific indications?
Yeah, that's a good question, Mira. I think early on in my experience, I would choose patients and I would image them. I'd scan them with a CT and I'd look for ones that were good candidates. And same in general surgery, the patients that are going to be more difficult, the larger or an obese patient, which is, more of a technical challenge, patients with comorbidities that are certainly more high risk. You don't tend to see those as the best candidates when you start your experience, but as you grow and your confidence grows, and at this point, over 95% of my mitral valve repairs are done MIS. And as your confidence grows with the procedure, you certainly, as a bigger patient population, you can benefit with that approach.
So I'm curious, is this something that you learned during training, or is this something that you picked up along the way?
Yeah, it's as I said, a lot of these skills I learned in my general surgery training, transferable to cardiac. And then I did get extra training. I had the benefit of, working here and being supported to travel to different places to learn techniques from surgeons that were, had mastered the technique. And then I had good support here in Calgary to develop the program as well. So again, mentors, ability to travel and see other surgeons operate. And it's a process and it's a learning experience. It requires a lot of commitment, but certainly something that I was very keen to learn.
You know, it's challenging sometimes when you're starting a new technique, especially when you have a well-established approach to doing this operation that, is reasonably well-validated and has reasonably good outcomes. I'm curious, and we talked about this a little bit already, but how do the outcomes compare between these two approaches? You mentioned there's less bleeding, perhaps. What other kinds of benefits or not have you noticed from a minimally invasive approach?
Yeah, no, glad you asked, because we're looking at that right now. And, it's true in all kinds of surgery. Surgical research is a little tougher because we aren't recruiting thousands and thousands of patients and giving them placebo drug versus a study drug. So in surgery, you're going to have smaller numbers. A lot of the early research is based on cohorts, doing meta-analyses and trying to figure out the benefits is a challenge. And particularly when you have a good standard of care. So for example, aortic valve replacement is a perioperative mortality of around 1 to 2%, and you know, outcomes are great. It's a good operation. So it's some of the you know, qualitative outcomes that you have to look at it in addition. So we've done some work here. We found that since we introduced the minimally invasive approach for the aortic valve, we're seeing less bleeding. So out of 100 patients, only 4 will require a blood transfusion. With a sternotomy, it's about 33%. And that's our results from this center. We'll see less atrial fibrillation. So about 20% atrial fibrillation or less than with a mini sternotomy or with a minimally invasive approach. And with sternotomy, you'll see, you know, 40% atrial fibrillation. In addition to that, it's quicker mobility. So no sternal precautions postoperatively. So they can use their walkers on day one. It's earlier discharge by about 1 to 2 days. And it's getting back to work, getting back to hiking the mountains. I had a patient recently who was a doctor who got back to his practice in 11 days after surgery. So this is stuff that we're not achieving with sternotomy. You know, I think we'll learn more and more as we do more research on the benefits of this approach.
What's your sense of the worldwide sort of adoption of MIS techniques, especially kind of given the things that you've talked about it being very challenging sometimes to move the dial on introducing a new technique or a new way of doing things?
Yeah, and there's always resistance because, and my colleagues would tell me, you know, why are you making it so difficult for yourself? You got a great operation with excellent results. Like, why are you doing this? You're putting the pain on yourself. But, you know, you see the benefit in the patients. You wanna push the field forward. You wanna do this not only to advance the field, but you know, mainly help your patients. And it's very rewarding when they your patients sell you on it. Really, they tell you how quickly they've got back to work, back to doing things, back to activities, and how minimal the pain was, and all that. And that sort of that really drives you. But until you start seeing those kind of outcomes, it is a tough go at first. And I think that's why many surgeons are reluctant to. And so, yeah, it requires, the data helps as you know, as more surgeons are convinced of the data and realize this is worth my while and I got to put effort into this, and the tide turns and more people are sold on doing it. But it's like anything else, when you start at first, it's you don't have all that many believers, but it grows.
Yeah, it's interesting to reflect and talk about and think about the introduction of new technology or innovations in general. And you know, you and one of your partners, of course, wrote a really neat editorial about the importance of patient-centered metrics in evaluating these techniques. And I think that's sort of really what you're touching on. Mm-hmm. I'm curious how you guys, you and he, or you specifically, approach partners in your group that perhaps would be a little bit more resistant to that change. And certainly it's not, you know, like they're not going to retire in the next couple of years. How do you sell them? How do you have your patients sell them? How do you bring them into that fold and really show them benefit and convince them to jump on the boat with you?
Yeah. And that's true. I mean, and you know what we all do, right? You've got, we all have our differences in our practices, and you got to respect your colleagues for their opinions and the way they do things. And as surgeons, we've got to have a comfort level with things. And so when I have a colleague say to me, like, I don't believe really in what you're doing, in the sense that I want to do things, this is the way I'm comfortable in doing this operation, you can't convince me that I should do it your way. On one hand, I respect that. I mean, we all have our own comfort level, and you know, however you want to sort of get your patient safely through an operation is reasonable. But you know, it at the same time, it is good for us to challenge each other, and it's good for us to challenge our partners and say, this is why I think this is better. The response I get from that is, yeah, well, show me the data. And so it often comes down to that. And it's on me, and it's on all of us that want to innovate. You do have to, you do have to do the studies, and you do have to, we're all evidence-based, or at least we should be. So it does come down to that. And
yeah, it's so true. There is an art to convincing, mm-hmm. you know, colleagues both locally and nationally, even internationally, to come along on that voyage. How was the actual sort of technical side of getting approval to introduce a new technique and technology like this from a nuts and bolts point of view? Was it difficult, or was it quite reasonable? How did sort of the healthcare region that you're in view that and deal with
it? Well, you know, in Canada, it is a challenge, and I think it's a good challenge to, you know, we're not introducing technology to make money for our hospital. We're introducing new technology, and we're innovating for the betterment of the patients and patient outcomes. So that's a good measuring stick, and that's how we're measured. So I think I've always found if we can demonstrate that this is going to be better for patients, and it's not cost prohibitive, we do have to be cost conscious about some of these things, then it does become an argument that can be made. And I found, you know, of course there were some battles early on in terms of, you know, you want that cross clamp that costs like 20 grand for what? What's wrong with this one? But you know, for the most part, there is support, and if you're passionate about it and you can make a good argument that's based in good evidence and benefit of patient care, then I think you get supporters.
I wanted to circle back a little bit to the, you know, the difference between this approach versus a catheter-based approach. Do you think the big advantage still from a surgical approach to valve replacement is that is the longevity of the valves going forward? Or what do you think are the big advantages over, let's say, you know, a catheter-based approach to valve replacement?
Yeah, so, you know, that's a massive advance for cardiology and cardiac surgery is percutaneous valve replacements, and it's not so applicable to many of the many of the tricuspid valve, mitral valve. Only the aortic valve is really amenable to it, and that's because it's got a more rigid annulus that you can balloon open a valve inside a stent, and so it saved a lot of patients the morbidity associated with surgery. And but the thing we don't know is long-term outcome. So is there a consequence of collapsing down a valve and crimping it up and putting it through the femoral artery? You know, is there a consequence of that? So we don't have 20-year data like we do in surgical valves. So that's still to be determined. But, you know, I got to say, it's gonna be at least 50% of aortic stenosis patients are going to be managed with transcatheter approaches, particularly the high-risk ones. And the technology is going to advance, and it's probably going to be more and more and more. So it's a good thing for patients. It's certainly less invasive, less traumatic, much easier recovery.
One of the last things that we wanted to ask you, which I think is quite topical based on some of your comments in terms of the synergy between your general surgery training and really pushing the envelope and pushing hard with regard to innovation in cardiac surgery, is that link. What is your sense of direct entry cardiac surgery programs, which, you correct me if I'm off here, but it seems to be the standard for a while, at least in this country. What do you think the pros and the cons are of that?
Yeah, model? Real good question, Chad. I think that I'm a bit biased on this, as you might guess, because I train fully as a general surgeon, and I think there's a tremendous benefit to that. I think that in addition to learning the transferable skills in general surgery, it took me a while to learn if I was suited for a career in cardiac surgery. And I think that direct entry program is maybe a more efficient way to do it. But there are a lot of medical students that go directly into cardiac surgery that realize they're not cut out for it. And it's It's a unique, I guess I would say that there's more latitude to form a practice that's suited to you in general surgery. In cardiac surgery, you gotta have an academic practice for sure, with the associated research and administrative demands. And it's busy. It can't be sort of an outpatient practice at all. And the operations are long. And, you know, so everybody's not suited to that. So I think it takes a bit to figure out if you're that kind of person. And, you know, in general surgery, you got a lot more options. You can do that sort of academic practice like you do, Chad, with all those administrative and research responsibilities. But you can also have a community practice. And I don't think people know in medical school exactly what kind of a practice they want to have. They learn that as they go through their residency training. And so I think that's a downside. And there are a lot of direct entry cardiac surgery residents who end up not finishing and or transfer out. And I think the proportion of that is higher. I don't have data for you in that, but I have, I can tell you that's true.
Well, this has been an absolutely fascinating discussion. Once again, thank you again for joining us. One of the questions we ask everybody, almost everybody on the podcast, is if you could go back in time and give yourself advice as a trainee, what would that advice be, having had the career that you've had thus far?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think your career becomes really hard in residency. And if I could, so there was a point at the end of my residency training into fellowship where I almost thought it wasn't worth it. And I think I'd almost go back and give myself a pep talk, say, this is hard, but it is the most rewarding career that you can have. And once you get out in practice and you gain confidence as a surgeon and you start to see the real rewards and the benefits that you do for patients, and you can't understand how rewarding that is as a resident. And so when you get there, I got to say, to me, it's been the most rewarding career I could ever hope to have. And so even in those dark days of no sleep and slogging it away in residency, it's really something that makes it all worthwhile. So if I could go back and tell myself, you know, it's okay, like, you know, you're going to be fine and you're going to enjoy this as much as I ended up enjoying it, it'd be helpful.
You've been listening to Cold Steel, the official podcast of the Canadian Journal of Surgery. If you like what you've heard, please leave us a review on iTunes. We'd love to hear your thoughts, comments, and feedback, so send us an email at podcast.cjs@gmail.com or tweet at us @CanJSurge. Thanks again.